can't trust someone that wears a Chevy hat.
How so?
What's what?
How so?
What do you mean? Well, you drive vehicles that, like, the transmissions drop, the engines blow up.
You drive off the airport.
What?
You drive the Ford guy?
Yeah. I drive a real man's truck. I got
450. Right,
you
truck found dead on the
side of the road, right? Oh, I find
you go down that way. Well,
now you'd like Dad's car. Ooh.
Yeah.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No, my mom was mad when he bought it.
Hey, guys deserve to have toys. Right?
Yeah.
It's not that.
No. Cost is not a problem.
Well, it wasn't just how much it cost. It was how much he took out of his retirement to buy it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Good. All right. So, you know, every now and then I'll do one-liners. And I get it. History's not exactly everyone's bag. That's fine. But the importance of history is, in history, you can learn lessons. And ultimately, the one thing that we all should strive in our lives is to avoid doing stupid things. And how can we judge stupidity? Well, you're thinking about doing an action. Step one, step two, step three. But then you look into it, and you can see that by doing that action, an action that other people have done multiple times, it's always resulted in bad things. Now, one would think if human beings were really clever, they would say, oh, 1, 2, 3 equals bad. I am not going to do 1, 2, 3. But you know the funny thing about history? What history shows is no, human beings are not that smart. And we constantly do the same things over and over again. So, for 100 years, Europe was ripping itself apart over the proper way to interpret the Bible. Granted, the corruption of the church is what caused people like Erasmus and Luther and Zwingli, etc. But in the wake of all those movements, there was nothing but violence. There was nothing but wars. There was nothing but death. And then one would think, all of the wars, for the most part, ended the same way. Whoever was in charge could make the decisions about the religion. And the places that did not see violence return ever again after they made that decision were those places that said, okay, fine, even though the person in charge can make the rules about the religion, let's just let everyone live as well. Live and let live. That's kind of what the Bible says after all. But did Europe figure it out after seeing thousands and thousands and thousands, by this point, by 1600, millions of people die? Nope. I give you the last. This was the war that finally made Europe realize, you know, killing other Christians because they interpret the Bible a little differently is just stupid. I give you the 30 Years' War. Now, this war should have never escalated to the level that it did. It should have just remained a tiny little skirmish that would have rectified itself. It would have worked its way out. But the problem is the problem similar to what resulted in World War I. There were sides that were drawn, and on both sides there were alliances. The cause was the same royal family that had been ruling much of Europe for centuries, the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs are the family of Charles V. If you recall, after 20 years of ruling in chaos, being the Holy Roman Emperor and the King of Spain, Charles V essentially would retire, would become a monk, and would give up his thrones. Spain went to his son Philip. The Holy Roman Empire, the Kingdom of Austria, and thus the Holy Roman Empire, would go to his brother Ferdinand. Why? Well, Charles basically recognized all of this empire was too much for one person. So, better to split it, and it would allow better direct management. Well, the thing is, because you had a dynamic now of an uncle and a nephew, the Habsburgs would remain constant allies for the next 80 years. So whenever Spain went to war, Austria and the Holy Roman Empire joined them. And vice versa. But, seeing all the devastation that was caused in the central part of the continent after Charles V, all of his successors in both kingdoms did not allow tensions to rise to the level that would culminate in the wars like the Schmalkaldic Wars. That was until 1619. When the grandson of Ferdinand I, Ferdinand II, was crowned Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Ferdinand had been educated by the Jesuits. And that education resulted in him being, let's just say, religiously intolerant. And he essentially wanted to be the man responsible for tipping the needle back to the Catholic side. In other words, this notion that Europe is divided, that just doesn't work. We need to be able to bring the Protestant world back into the Catholic world to reestablish once again the supremacy of the church. He maintained an alliance with his nephew, Philip IV, the ruler of Spain. And together, they decided, you know something? The Council of Trent made its rulings, and now I think we should impose a counter-reformation on our domains. Well, for Spain, it was no problem, because going back to Ferdinand and Isabella in the Reconquista, they had already purged Spain of the Jews and the Muslims, and Protestantism never took root. But in the Holy Roman Empire, where it was split, this would be the perfect place to try. But in order to try it, they needed a trigger. And lo and behold, they would get one. In the Kingdom of Bohemia, which was a large kingdom, you can see here in the red, which took up a large territory within the Holy Roman Empire. Bohemia, if you recall, had been a pseudo-Catholic state going back to the time of Jan Hus. They had been technically Catholic, but they were pretty much allowed to have a Protestant-style Catholicism. And prior to Frederick, all of their rulers had been kind of Catholic. Well, in 1619, there was a vacancy in the throne, and the electors in Bohemia went through the family tree and they found an offshoot branch that had Frederick. Frederick was of Palatine, another German state. So, they chose him, connected to the bloodline of the Bohemian kings, and he was already an established ruler. He had experience. He would be a good choice. But the problem was, he was not a pseudo-Catholic. He was a Calvinist. But the Bohemians didn't care, because again, their version of Catholicism had always been kind of Protestant-like, going back to the Hussite Wars. Well, here you go. In Ferdinand's mind, there is now a real possibility that this huge kingdom would suddenly switch into the Protestant camp. And this was something Ferdinand could not stand for. So, he decides to provoke a civil war. How does he do it? Class warfare. He begins making promises to the nobles that if they come out as Catholics, then he will grant them lands and titles and opportunities. But the problem is the peasants were Hussites. So they were more Protestant than they were Catholic. And they were okay with having Frederick. They loved the idea. Because again, Calvinism, if you recall, one of the central tenets of Calvinism, other than predestination, is the localized control of religion. So in the minds of the peasants, this guy is going to basically allow us to keep doing what we've been doing for about 200 years. Well, obviously the nobles have all the money. The nobles have the soldiers, but the peasants have the numbers. To make matters worse, Ferdinand promises additional troops to the nobles. So he begins marching in not only Austrian soldiers, but he also borrows from Philip, and he sends Spanish soldiers in as well. And before long, chaos erupts. Over the next 2 years, all of Bohemia is completely devastated. Every single city and town saw violence, destruction. So much so that 3/4 were completely devastated, burned to the ground. Europe had never seen anything like this before. It got so bad that not only was the entire noble class pretty much wiped out, but an estimated 2.2 out of 2.7 million Bohemians died. It was almost completely depopulated. Well, as the horrors of this devastation began spreading around the European continent, leaders, Catholic and Protestant alike, are horrified by this. So an international war would be triggered. Because in the minds of Ferdinand, look, we just basically reconquered Bohemia. We just reestablished Catholicism. So what if we kill 2.2 million people? Oops. Let's go on to the next kingdom and the next kingdom. Well, of course, by doing so, this would be a direct violation of the Peace of Augsburg. But Ferdinand and Philip don't care. Their armies start marching into all of the Protestant kingdoms, one at a time, unleashing devastation, unleashing death. And then to make matters worse, other countries join in. Not that they care about spreading Catholicism or preserving Protestantism. They just don't want the wars to spread out into the whole continent. Denmark sends armies. Sweden sends armies. Even France, who is a Catholic country, comes in on the side of the Protestants to beat the Habsburgs. From 1619 all the way up until 1643, Habsburgs are winning until the pendulum suddenly switched the other way. In 1643, fed up with how things were going in the Holy Roman Empire, France decides, instead of sending troops in there to fight the Habsburgs, they actually sent an army and they invade Spain. When that occurred, it forced the Spanish to pull out all of their troops to try to get them back to defend their country. And by the time the Spanish troops arrived, they were exhausted. And the French decimated their forces, causing Spain to suddenly drop out of the war because they had no army. Then the following year, a similar thing would happen to the Austrian army. At the Battle of Jankau, which was near Prague. Once both powers lost their armies, neither had the funds or the ability to rebuild their armies, so they had to agree to a settlement. In the end, the son of Ferdinand II, who had been ruling since 1637, Ferdinand III, would basically agree to bring the war to an end. It would take 2 years of negotiation, but in the end, the 30 Years' War would end with the signing of the Treaty of Westphalia. And guess what the principle of this treaty was? Eos religio. Quis religio, eos religio. Whose rule is religion. Years of violence, devastation, death, destruction. And they basically said, oh, my bad. And they ended this war the same way the Wars of Capella did. But within the next decade or two after the signing of the Treaty of Westphalia, the same thing happened in the Holy Roman Empire as what would happen in Sweden. Within 20 years, all of the local rulers, Catholic and Protestant alike, had made laws in their kingdoms allowing Christians to privately worship whatever type of Christian faith they wanted to. And in some places, those protections even were extended to Jews. Why? Well, they finally figured out killing people over the way you read a book is stupid. This was one of the most devastating events in Western civilization. For 30 years, armies marched around the central part of Europe. And during that time, 30% of the German population was killed. 30%. Some 7.5 million out of a total population of 21 million. And what killed them? Well, the same things that happened in all long wars. Yes, there was death on the battlefield, but there was also death resulting from the fact that the armies didn't have grocery stores or DoorDash. You know, the armies marched around and they lived off the land, so they moved into a village and they took all the food, leaving no food for the peasants, and they died of starvation. There also was an outbreak of the plague during this war. So in the end, not only was the population devastated, but so was the economy. The economy of the Holy Roman Empire would not recover until after the Napoleonic Wars, 200 years later. Plus, that's one of the reasons why the Holy Roman Empire remained decentralized. None of the Protestant or Catholic princes would allow the emperor to rule as an absolute monarch. It would remain a confederation. So the states kind of had more power than the central government because of what took place. Why are we going to give all the power to one guy when we saw what one guy will do? This war ultimately is also what crushed the Spanish Empire. Spain would never recover from this. After the 30 Years' War, Spain stopped conquering. Their empire was maxed out in the New World. They just couldn't do any more. What else have we got? Well, two other things. You would also see the emergence of nation states. Nations started saying, yeah, why are we going to make alliances based on religion? How is that good for us? And of course, the 30 Years' War, most importantly, would mark the last large-scale war of religion in Europe. Tragically, it took 10, 15 million deaths to figure this out. But that didn't mean Europe stopped fighting. No. No, just the reasons for war would change. Questions?
Right. Religion, and then I'll switch over to the last section. State building. Really, it marks the beginning of modernity.
All right. Once the wars of religion ended, politically, the dynamic in Europe changed. Again, they would focus on nation states.
England became focused on the English. The French became focused on the French. The Germans focused on the Germans. It wasn't about Protestant versus Catholic.
Now, during this time period, there was a lot of things going on all across the continent. But historians often compare and contrast the two extremes, the bookends of these developments. England and France. Why? Well, as a result of state building, one of them would emerge as a constitutional monarchy in which there would be developments like checks and balances, separation of power, constitutional protections. And on the other hand, would be the exact opposite, an absolute monarchy where the kings would have all power over life in their kingdom. But no spoilers. No spoilers. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at the bookends, because England and France are those bookends. And all of the European kingdoms would do the kind of same thing, but they would go a little bit towards one way or a little bit towards the other. But England and France mark the extremes. So rather than talking about what took place in Spain and Portugal and Italy and all the German kingdoms and Russia, it's easier just to talk about these two. The fun began in England upon the death of the individual regarded as one of the greatest monarchs in English history, Elizabeth. The woman who figured out how to avoid religious division in her kingdom first, before anybody else. And I want to emphasize, I said her. Yes, Elizabeth is a woman. And that's what makes her unique. Because remember, across all of Europe, women were not allowed to be sovereigns. They were queens, but they weren't rulers. Elizabeth was a ruler, and she ruled effectively. But she did make one mistake, and nobody is exactly sure why she made it. She never married. She was queen for 45 years. But she never married. She was known to history as the Virgin Queen. So because she never married, guess what she did not have? Right, remember the one thing that her father was obsessed with. And maybe that's part of the reason why. I mean, again, I'm no psychologist, but I hate to break it to you all, but none of you are really unique. You are all creations of the environment in which you were born in. So there's a little bit of mom in you, there's a little bit of dad in you. And that is going to leave an impact. That's going to affect you for the rest of your life. It's not a bad thing. It's just the way we are. Well, it's possible the reason why she never married is because, well, look at what her father did. Killed three wives, basically. You know? Slept around, liked whoring, produced bastards. You know, that's the reason why, you know, kids who are sexually abused, you know, make interesting choices for the rest of their life. They're scarred, they're impacted. So she could have been impacted by it, don't know. But at the end of the day, there was a vacancy on the throne. But interestingly enough, neither she in her last days nor Parliament freaked out because there was a law in place made by her father way back in 1543, the Act of Succession. Edward, her half-brother, who was king for 6 years and died heirless. Then it went to her half-sister, Mary, who was queen for 6 years, died heirless. Then it went to Elizabeth, who was queen for 45 years, died heirless. But then, under the law, the throne would pass to the descendants of Henry's sister, Margaret. Margaret had been married off to James IV of Scotland, who gave birth to several sons, but it would be her third son who would become king upon the death of her husband. He would be James V. James V had lots of bastards, but he would produce one legitimate heir, and that was Mary, Queen of Scots, who we know was forced to abdicate after she was sleeping around and flee to England. She had her head cut off too. But when Mary abdicated the Scottish throne in 1567, the throne would be given to her one-year-old son, who would be crowned James VI. Fast forward 36 years later.
This essentially meant that under the law of England,
James VI of Scotland was the next in line for the English throne. Parliament would invite him to come to London. He accepted the appointment, and he would be crowned James I. But throughout his life,
he was a king in two kingdoms simultaneously. James I in England, James VI in Scotland.
Now here's the irony. He was king of Scotland for 36 years. He was educated by his nobles who served as his regents up to the time when he was legally allowed to rule in his own name, which in Scotland was 17. So he had been educated on how to efficiently rule. And then over the next 20 years, he was a good king. He established an effective government. He maintained relative peace amongst all the nobles. He maintained strong foreign relations. In fact, even though Elizabeth had killed his mother, when the Spanish Armada was threatening England, James contacted Elizabeth and said, "Do you want me to send Scottish troops to help you out?" So, throughout most of his reign, Scotland saw nearly 30 years of peace, which is unprecedented in most of Scottish history. You look at Scottish history, and the Scots were always fighting one another. The Scots, the Highlanders against the Lowlanders, they hated one another and they loved fighting. Although you can't blame them. I mean, after all, Scotland is not really a warm country. It's kind of like the climate of like Maine. And they did kind of wear kilts. And guys, you know what happens when it gets cold? That makes some guys a little angry, cranky, shrinkage, and all the rest. But he was a good king. England got lucky. So when he came to the throne, he brought that experience. So even though technically he was a foreigner, he would bring the same dynamic for the most part in England. Focusing on peace, focusing on economic expansion and stability, maintaining good relations with the nobles and Parliament. So much so that throughout his reign, it would be James who would actually coin the phrase of Great Britain. He wanted to essentially fuse together all of his kingdoms.
He was technically the King of England, the King of Wales, the King of Scotland, and the King of Ireland.
Wales and England had pretty much already been fused together. But Ireland had its own parliament. Scotland had its own parliament. So because it was one guy sharing these monarchies, he actually argued that, you know, we should just merge everything together. Let's become one. Scotland was down for it.
Ireland was like, the English have a tendency to genocide us. And the English were like, hell no.
So ultimately, even though he coined the phrase, you would not have a united kingdom until centuries later.
Now the only flaw, if you call it a flaw, is that because he was experienced, he would do everything he could to essentially rule. He didn't want to necessarily collaborate with Parliament.
Now, ironically,
The reason why is because he had his own ideas about monarchy.
In fact, he actually wrote a book on it in 1597 called The True Law of Free Monarchies.
This would be his academic attempt to basically justify the right of one person to rule.
And he made many arguments in favor of it, and these are arguments that continue to this day.
His biggest argument in favor of it is if you try collaboration, ruling by committee, nothing ever gets done. Because everyone ends up being self-serving and selfish, and they argue amongst themselves.
By the way, you know how I know he's true?
Have I played the pizza game with you yet? No? All right, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
15 people in the room.
15 people in the room.
Alright, here we go.
15 people in the room.
We are gonna order pizza. But we are only allowed to order one type of pizza. But we all have to agree on it. Okay? Here we go.
Hurts me to say this. Hawaiian pizza. How many people are in favor of Hawaiian pizza? Look at that. One. Do we have a united consensus? No. All right. Screw you with that Hawaiian pizza. Pineapple pizza. All right. Let's have sausage pizza. Don't be like sausage on the pizza. Alright, fine. Let's have onions on the pizza. Who's down for onions on the pizza? Seriously? Alright, fine. Chicken barbecue pizza. How many people like chicken barbecue pizza? Barbecue chicken pizza? Seriously, you gotta decide. It's not
options.
Stand up for yourselves. If you like something, demand it. This is what I want. How about chicken? Oh, what the hell is the shit my daughter gets? Chicken broccoli. No, chicken Alfredo pizza. That's what she likes. Chicken Alfredo pizza. Taco pizza. Hamburg pizza. How many people like plain pizza? We still not all agreeing. See, this is what ruling by council results in. You cannot get everyone to agree. So you know something? Screw the democracy stuff. I'm going to rule as an absolute ruler because it's easier for one person to make the decision. And you know what my choice is? Anchovy pizza. Live with it. Simpler, cleaner, cheaper, more efficient. One person makes all the decisions, the other people, because you're not king, has to suck it up. Argument number two. God. God. How does one become king? Well, obviously, not everyone can become king. In any kingdom, there's only one king or queen. Who gets to be king? Well, ultimately, God decides. God is the great creator. God is responsible for everything. So if somehow you end up being king or queen, it's because God wanted you to be. So, what's going to give the king the right to make all the choices for the pizza, everyone? God does. By the way,
That's known as divine rights of kings. And by the way, in his book, James actually justifies it in Scripture. He said, and I quote, "Kings are called gods by the prophetical King David because they sit upon God's throne on earth and have to account for their administration to give up to him." So, one person is the most efficient way to make decisions, and that one person has the authority because God says so. This essentially would become known as absolutism, where the king has all the authority. Absolute power. The power literally over life and death. Now, by the way, are there any checks and balances on absolutism? Well, yes. And this is the final part that you need to know. So one, we need to know that one person ruling is cleaner than, you know, discussions, councils. God wants them to be. Give them all the power. And here's the final thing. Can a king go too far? Yes, he says so. But who is authorized to hold the king accountable? Not the Pope. We're talking Protestant kingdoms here. No. No, what James says is the person who's able to hold the king accountable is the guy upstairs. Because after all, what happens to you if you are a bad person and you commit sin? You gotta burn in hell. So, kings can do whatever they want so long as they uphold tradition, so you can't go against the values of the kingdom, and you don't violate the covenants of God. What happens if you do? Well, as he says, you will stir up such scourges as pleaseth God, for he punishes wicked kings. So, during his reign, he would rule without parliament because he believed he could do so. And throughout his reign, not only in Scotland, but once he became King of England, throughout most of his reign, there was peace. He was making good decisions. The economy was growing. England avoided wars. There was no religious violence. But he did have one flaw. And he was forced to call Parliament in 4 times during his reign. Why? Well, see, and you can kind of get this from his royal painting. Because he was king, and he felt that he could pretty much do whatever he wanted, he liked the good stuff. So he spent a lot of money on renovating his palaces, he spent lots of money on clothes, spent lots of money on jewelry. He liked the bling. But the problem is when the king spends money, he's spending the taxes that are collected for the realm. So, there were 4 times during his reign when he spent so much money, he actually triggered inflation. You know, just like the last president did with all his spending bills that they passed. Prices went through the roof. So, he actually had to call Parliament in to help stabilize the economy by increasing taxes.
while he was a spender, hands down, most historians give him the most area of success for his foreign policy.
One of the biggest accomplishments that he achieved
early in his reign, 1604, he'd only been on the throne for a year, was he ended an undeclared war with Spain that had been going on since Philip II tried to basically destroy England.
He also ratcheted down the pirates, the privateers.
He basically ordered all of the English ship captains no longer to prey upon Spanish shipping. Why? Peace. It was also when James was king that Jamestown was founded in the New World and Plymouth was founded right down the road.
And most importantly, he also kept England out of the 30 Years' War.
Good rule, efficient rule. While he's not necessarily one of the favorites, most historians give him props. He's in the top 30% of English rulers. And it's also during his reign that England experienced a boom in literature. Shakespeare was alive and writing and putting on his plays during the reign of James I. When we get to the Scientific Revolution for the final, it was during his reign that the methodology for scientific inquiry would be developed by Lord Francis Bacon. But the thing that he gets the most credit for is in 1611, he would sponsor one of the most important books ever written in the English language. A book that bears his name. The King James Bible. The King James Bible was technically the third translation of the Bible. The first was Wycliffe's. The second was a translation that was based on Erasmus's book. But this book was a game changer because it de-emphasized the Catholic tenets that justified the church, but overemphasized the king. So any passage where king was mentioned, king was anointed as the rightful ruler of the spiritual and the temporal, because God makes kings. From 1603 all the way up until 1625, he ruled England like he had done for 36 years prior in Scotland. Good ruler, effective ruler, stable environment for the people. But unfortunately, in March 1625, James fell victim to the same thing that's going to happen to all of you. One day, you're going to get sick, and you're going to die. Because death is inevitable. Poor guy would suffer a stroke and would die peacefully in his sleep. But no worries. He had performed his kingly duty.
Now, there are some historians that compare James I and his rule to the reign of Henry VII.
Similarly,
historians compare the reign of Henry VIII, the reign of Charles I.
Like Henry VIII, Charles was the second son of his father.
He should not have been king.
It should have gone to his older brother. But, similar to what happened to Arthur, Charles's brother Henry got sick and died, making Charles in 1612 the heir apparent. Now, what's the difference? Well, and I really hate to break it to you if you are the second or the third or the fourth born child of your parents, but in terms of effective parenting, the firstborn gets the best. Why? Well, mom and dad are wicked hyper nervous. It's the first child, and they overemphasize everything.
But by the time the second kid comes around, mom, dad are like, oh, it's no big deal. And then by the third and the fourth, it's like, whatever.
Well, Henry was given to the best tutors, was highly educated. Whereas Charles, well, he was the second born. He was just the kid that was the spare. So he didn't get the best tutors when he was a young kid. He was allowed to play and go outside and frolic. Didn't focus on academics.
Plus, it seems that James really didn't like Charles as Charles started getting a little older.
And again, oof, that does happen. Parents do play favorites. And there are some times when parents like look at their kids, they're like, wow, that kid's a brat. None of you, though. All your parents love you. You're all the favorites.
So this kid, not best educated, not really kept at his father's side, not mentored to rise up to the role, but he was like Henry. He kind of was like a young playboy. But unlike Henry, when Henry VIII came to the throne,
everybody in England was happy.
When Charles came to the throne,
not that they had popular opinion polls, but it seems that most people in England were not happy with the fact that the good King James had died, and now this is what we're stuck with. Why? Well,
he, unlike his father, who made decisions based on reason, rationale, thought, analysis. Charles made his decisions with his naughty bits.
James ended the war with Spain by promising an arranged marriage that would bind Philip III's Spain with James I as England. The betrothal involved Philip's daughter, Maria Anna,
with Charles.
Well, shortly before the time, now they were betrothed back when they were like two.
Well, at some point when Charles was in his 20s, before his father died, he decides to go and check out his wife-to-be.
Because that's the thing about arranged marriages. Typically, the potential bride and the potential groom were not allowed to see each other before the marriage. So he decides to sneak out of England, disguised himself as a commoner, gets on board a ship, takes a few weeks, but eventually he gets his way down to Spain. Somehow, he not only managed to get to the palace anonymously, he didn't declare himself,
But somehow he actually got into the palace. And not only did he get into the palace, but he got within sight of Anna Maria. And he looked at her, and he was like, she's not exactly hot. Well, after he saw his potential bride-to-be, then he got caught, so he had to declare himself, so he didn't get killed. And then he had conversations with Philip III. And what does Philip tell Charles? Well, Philip expected that Charles and Anna Maria get married in a Catholic church, which means he's going to have to convert to Catholicism, which is something he does not want to do. Now, if she was hot, he might have, but she was not. So he said, I'll get back to you. Then he left Spain, gets on a ship, starts making his way home, got sidetracked, ended up in France, of all places, decides to go to his distant cousin, Henri IV, go to Paris, go to the king of France at the time, and get, you know, some food and some wine and all the rest. And there in the palace, he sees with his own eyes one of Henri's daughters, Henrietta Maria. Oh, she was a hottie. Now, if you recall, Henry IV, to become king, he did convert to Catholicism. So his daughter, Henrietta Maria, was a Catholic. And in order for them to be married, they would have to be married in a Catholic church. But this time around, he said, oh yeah, I'm down. Well, word gets back to Parliament, and Parliament's like, dude, we dealt with religion. You're supposed to be a Protestant. You're not supposed to be a Catholic. Because if you're a Catholic, that means technically you're going to be make decisions based on what the Pope wants, not what's good for England. But he promised he's not going to do any religious stuff. So against their better judgment, Parliament allowed him to be coronated. Well, after he gets crowned, has the formal coronation ceremony, all the laws are followed, he officially becomes king, almost right out of the gates, what starts happening? Well, he starts clashing with the Parliament. Why? Well, he wants to get involved in the 30 Years' War. Parliament says, no, we're not going to send over English troops. Charles is like, well, I'm king, and I should be able to control foreign policy. In the end, Parliament says, fine, we're not going to send any English soldiers, but we'll send some money to help out the Protestants. Then Charles wants to unleash the privateers to prey upon Spanish shipping. Parliament says, well, your father brought peace with Spain. Why do we want to fight a war with Spain? He's like, well, I'm king. I want it. Parliament said, well, we'll allow a little bit under rules. And basically the rules were the only way an English privateer could take a Spanish ship is if they literally were in the middle of the Atlantic and there was no other ship within sight. So in other words, if they caught the Spanish ship, no one would see. The rules also required the execution of every single Spanish soldier on the ship, so there would be no witnesses.
And if the English privateers failed, Parliament would deny the legality of their terms.
Now, why was Charles acting like this? Well, he completely believed in absolutism and divine rights. So, whereas James, being experienced, yes, he said God made him king. Yes, therefore he should have all the power. James understood there is a way to do things. Tact. Diplomacy. Trying to get consensus before you make a decision. Charles was like, I don't care. I'm king. He wanted to make all the decisions, but he screwed up because he was not that intelligent.
He never realized that he didn't have the people on his side. He didn't have a social base.
Why? Unlike his father, the English people really didn't like him. By the way, if the people like the leader can do much more than if the leader is not liked. He also did not have a standing army. So it's not like, well, to get his way, he could just unleash the troops and shoot anybody who was against him. England raised armies through militias. So the militias were organized on the local level by the local government, and then the crown would call for the raising of a national army, and all of the provinces would basically muster together militias from local communities. But the moment the war was over, everyone went back home to the farm. So, in order for him to get what he wanted all the time, the people had to support him. He needed to have a standing army. Oh, and you know the other thing he needed to have? Money.
But going all the way back to 1215, the kings of England did not control the money. Because there was a king, King John I, Lackland, the brother of Richard the Lionhearted. John fought the barons of England and lost and had to sign the Magna Carta.
And in the Magna Carta, Parliament controlled the purse strings.
So he couldn't raise an army if he wanted to because he had no money.
So he had to basically stay in his lane.
But then, lo and behold, he did something that was just pure proof that he was dumb.
Brought up religion. Why? Well, he was technically the head of the Church of England. As had been his father, as has been Elizabeth. Mary Tudor was not, but Edward was and Henry was. So because he was the head of the church, he was technically allowed to make religious rules. And one of the things that he did not like Calvinism. For two reasons. One, he didn't believe in predestination. I mean, come on now. Have any of you been into the birthing room when a baby was born? No, none of you have seen birth?
I have. I've seen birth twice. And I can tell you, after witnessing the birth, not only is it gross, but when the baby out, he does not have a document with him basically saying, you are going to go to heaven. You are going to go to hell. Nor is there any stamps or marks.
So how does one know if you are in fact predestined? Well, James said that's foolish. Sorry, Charles said that's foolish. He said, no, do you want to know what determines if you're going to go to heaven or hell? You. Through what today we refer to as free will. No one can force you to live a good life. No one can force you to live according to the tenets of Jesus. It's up to you. But know this, if you are bad, if you are violent, if you are malicious, there are consequences. And so as you're spending eternity down in hell burning, you got no one else to blame but you. But you're not there because God wanted you to go to hell. Because what kind of God is that? No, God gives you the opportunity, the choice. And it's up to you to decide. He also didn't like the local control. Instead, he was more into the institutional hierarchy in terms of church systems. He was in favor of the Episcopalian model, in which there would be bishops, well, archbishops at the top, bishops, priests, all organized based on parishes. And of course, the king is on the top. The same model that the Catholic Church is based on, except again in England, the king is the head, not the pope. Versus the Calvinist model, the local control. Particularly, he didn't like the system that was created in Scotland, which is the Presbyterian version of Calvinism, where the presbyters, who are the elders of the community, make the decision. Well, here's the funny thing. Technically, he's arguing for the English system that goes all the way back to Henry VIII. But there were many people in both Scotland and England that are saying, whoa, he sounded a lot like a Catholic. And maybe he sounded a lot like a Catholic because of her. The Queen. So he must be a Catholic. And he's going to bring religious wars. Well, we've got three more clicks and then we're done for the day. So, not only does Parliament not like him, not only do the people not like him, and not only does he have strong opinions on things, including religion, which of course is not going to make him popular whatsoever, he then goes and makes two critical mistakes that would be fateful for him personally. The first, he would actually create an Inquisition. This system would be known as the Star Chamber. Now, the Star Chamber was a court that was created by Elizabeth, but it was a special court. It was created to basically hold judges accountable. So it was like a review board. So if there was a judge anywhere in England and they were making decisions that seemed harmful to the people, the judge would be subpoenaed and brought before the Star Chamber. And he would have a trial where he would be investigated. And if he was found guilty of being abusive, he could be taken off the court, disbarred. So this had been there. But when James becomes king, he sees this appellate court, this review court, and he starts appointing hand-picked members. And then they changed the jurisdiction. Instead of just going after judges, the Star Chamber starts investigating people who James felt was a threat. They started investigating ideological differences with the state. So it wasn't just a judge making bad decisions. Now it could be anybody who said something that was disagreeable to the king. Kind of like what the church does with the Inquisition. Heresy. Well, not only did Charles use the Star Chamber to start going after Calvinists, he also started going after the Puritans. The Puritans are the Pilgrims. Those are the people who left England because they wanted to create their own religious community. So he starts stirring up religion. And then mistake number two, and this will be the last click of the day. Now, under the law of England at the time, Parliament did not meet like Congress does in our country, or even Parliament in England today. Today, our legislative bodies, like in England and most of the world, they constantly meet. They're almost always in session, all year long. Well, back in England, it was one of the powers of the king to call Parliament into session. So like I said, during the reign of his father, for the most part, Parliament wasn't in session, but there were four times the king was forced to call him into session. Well, not only does the king have the power to call Parliament into session, the king can also end the session. So that's what he does. In 1629, he decides to disband Parliament. He ends the session and kind of says, I'm never going to call you again. What caused it? Charles was trying to coerce Parliament to raise taxes so he could raise a mercenary army to get England involved in the 30 Years' War. And Parliament essentially said no. So what does the king do? Throws a temper tantrum and disbands Parliament. So, if you criticize him, you could end up before the Star Chamber. And if you are a member of government, there are going to be no checks and balances on the king, because the king's going to do what he wants. What happens to spoiled children? Often. They get themselves in trouble.
We'll see what happens on whenever the next time I'm going to see you. What's today? Thursday? I'll see you on Tuesday.